A good 3 hours before sundown, Buck was approaching the entrance to the hideout. He had left signs farther down the trail to indicate the best way for Waters' men to follow him. Having dismounted some distance from the tunnel, he stole cautiously forward. He was halfway to the tunnel when he glimpsed the new sentry, sitting several yards from the mouth, near a clump of bushes. It was the scar-faced fellow Harrison had called Braxton, and he seemed wide awake. Buck began a stealthy and necessarily slow advance on the guard, swinging in a circle that would bring him behind the man. He crept up to within a dozen feet, obscured by a clump of mesquite bushes. Gathering a handful of pebbles, he rose quietly to his knees and threw them over the guard's head.
What the hell was that?
Braxton glared in the direction of the sound with his Winchester half lifted. And that was when Laramie leapt for him with his six gun raised like a club. Braxton slumped full length and lay still. Laramie took the belt and neckerchief from the unconscious man, bound and gagged his captive securely. He took the man's pistol, rifle, and spare bullets, then dragged him away from the tunnel mouth and shoved him in among a cluster of rocks and bushes, effectively concealing him from the casual glance.
So far, so good.
The success of the next step depended on whether or not all the outlaws of Harrison's band were in the hideout. Mart Raleigh was probably still back in San Leon, but Buck knew he should assume that all the other outlaws were inside. Slinging Braxton's rifle over his shoulder, he glanced up to a ledge overhanging the tunnel mouth, where stood precariously balanced the huge boulder which had given him the idea for this stage of the plan.
All I need now is a lever.
A broken tree limb sufficed for that, and a few moments later he had climbed to the ledge and was at work on the boulder. He felt a moment's panic as he feared its base was too deeply embedded, but under his fierce efforts, he felt the great mass give at last. The boulder toppled down into the tunnel entrance and jammed there, almost filling the space. The minor avalanche the boulder caused managed to fill any sizable gaps with smaller stones. The only way his enemies could get out now was by climbing the canyon walls, a feat he considered practically impossible, or by laboriously picking out the stones that had fallen around the boulder. At the spot on the canyon rim where he had spied upon the hideout that morning, he forted himself by the simple procedure of crouching behind a fair-sized rock with a Winchester and pistols handy at his elbows. He had scarcely taken his position when he saw a mob of riders breaking away from the corral behind the cabin. He counted 25 of them. Laramie squinted along the blue rifle barrel, waiting till the men were within about 300 yards of his position.
Here we go.
Dust spurted in front of the horse's hooves, and the riders scattered like quail.
Drop your guns and hoist your heads! The tunnel's blocked and you can't get out!
You go to hell!
Buck hadn't expected any other reply. His shout had been more for rhetorical effect than anything else. But there was nothing theatrical about his second shot, which knocked a man out of his saddle. The outlaws converged toward the tunnel entrance, firing as they rode, aiming at Buck's position, which they had finally located. Laramie replied in kind. Then half a dozen men in the lead jammed into the tunnel and found that Buck wasn't lying. The others slid from their horses and took cover behind the rocks that littered the edges of the canyon, dragging the wounded men with them. From a rush and a dash, the fight settled to a slow, deadly grind, with no one taking any chances. Having located Buck's small fort, the men below concentrated their fire on the spot of the rim he occupied. He had not seen either Raleigh or Harrison. Raleigh, he hoped, was still in San Leon, but the absence of Harrison worried him. If he too had gone to San Leon, there was every chance that he might get clean away, even if his band was wiped out. There was another chance that he or Raleigh, or both of them, might return to the hideout and attack him from the rear. Buck cursed himself for not having divulged the true identity of the gang's leader to Judy Anders, but he couldn't think straight when he talked to her. He knew at least six men were in the tunnel. If he didn't discourage them, they would eventually be breaking through the block tunnel and taking shots at him from the rear. But to effect this discouragement meant leaving his point of vantage and giving the men below a chance to climb the canyon wall. He didn't believe this could be done, but then he didn't know what additions to the fortress had been made by the new occupants. They might have chiseled out handholds at some point on the wall. He'd have to look at the tunnel. He worked his way down over the ledges.
Where the devil are Joel's men? I can't keep these hombres hemmed up forever.
Damn!
Stones and brush had been worked out at one place in the tunnel mouth, and the head and shoulders of a man appeared.
Get back in there!
The fellow vanished back inside. Laramie crouched, glaring. They would try it again soon. If he wasn't there to stop it, the whole gang would be squeezing out of the tunnel in no time. He couldn't get back to the rim and leave the tunnel unguarded, yet there was always the possibility of somebody climbing the canyon wall. Had he but known it, his fears were justified. For while Buck crouched on the ledge above, glaring down at the tunnel mouth, down in the canyon, a man was working toward a certain point of the cliff where his keen eyes had discerned something dangling. He had discovered Laramie's rope from his first venture to the canyon, hanging from the stunted tree on the rim. Cautiously, the man lifted himself out of the tall grass, ready to duck back in an instant. Then, as no shot came from the canyon rim, he scuttled like a rabbit toward the wall. Slinging his rifle on his back, he began swarming ape-like up the almost sheer wall. His outstretched arm grabbed the lower end of the rope, just as the others in the canyon saw what he was doing and began firing furiously at the rim to cover him.
Damn it. I hope they watch what they're shooting.
The outlaw went up with amazing agility, his flesh crawling with the momentary expectation of a bullet in his back. The renewed firing drew Buck back to his perch on the canyon rim. He spared only a limited glance over the rocks, for the bullets were winging so close that he dared not lift his head high. He didn't see the man on the rope cover the last few feet in a scrambling rush and haul himself over the rim, unslinging his rifle as he did so. Laramie turned and headed back for the ledge where he could see the tunnel opening. And as he did so, he brought himself into full view of the outlaw who was standing upright on the rim by the stunted tree. Buck felt a numbing impact in his left shoulder, knocking him off his feet, and his head hit hard against a rock. Down below, an outlaw came scrambling out of the tunnel with desperate haste, followed by another and another. Buck blinked and glared, then oriented himself. He saw five riders sweeping toward the tunnel, and six outlaws who had rushed out while he was briefly unconscious, falling back into it for shelter. He recognized the leader of the newcomers as Slim Jones, Joel Waters' foreman.
Take cover, Slim!
A barrage of lead poured from the tunnel mouth into which the outlaws had disappeared. Slim lost a man before his crew swerved their horses out of line and fell back to cover. Laramie suddenly remembered the slug that had felled him and turned to scan the canyon rim. He saw the man by the stunted tree then. The fellow was helping one of his companions up the same route he had taken, and evidently thought that his shot had settled Laramie, as he was making no effort at concealment. Laramie lifted his rifle and pulled the trigger.
Damn!
But he was out of rifle cartridges. Below him, Joel Waters' ranch hands were futilely firing at the tunnel entrance, and the outlaws within were wisely holding their fire until they could see something to shoot at. Laramie crawled along a few feet to put himself out of range of the rifleman on the rim.
Slim! Swing wide of that trail and come up here with your men!
He was understood, for presently, Slim and his three surviving men came crawling over the tangle of rocks, having necessarily abandoned their horses.
About time you was getting here. Give me some 30-30s.
A handful of cartridges were shoved into his eager fingers.
We come as soon as we could. Had to ride to the ranch to round up these men.
Where's Waters?
I left him in San Leon, cussing a blue streak because he couldn't get nobody to listen to him. Folks got no more sense than cattle. Just as easy to stampede and as hard to stop once they bust loose.
What about Bob Anders?
Doctor said he was just creased. He was just fixing to go over there when me and Joel come into town and he had to wait and dress Joel's leg. Anders hadn't come to yet last time the doc was there.
Buck felt some relief. At least Bob was going to live, even if he hadn't been able to name the man who shot him.
Unless Waters sends us more men, we're licked. Tunnel's cleared, and the men inside are climbing up the cliff.
Damn, Buck! You're shot!
Jones pointed to Buck's shoulder, the shirt soaked with blood.
Can't do nothing for it now, it ain't bleeding much. Well, give me that bandana.
He knotted the bandana into a crude bandage as he talked.
Three of you stay here and watch that tunnel. Don't let nobody out, you hear? Me and Slim are gonna circle around and argue with the gents climbing the cliffs. Come on, Slim.
It was rough climbing, and Laramie's shoulder burned like fire, with a dull throbbing that told him the lead was pressing near a bone. But he set his teeth and crawled over the rough rocks, keeping out of sight of the men in the canyon below, until they had reached a point behind his tiny fort on the rim, and that much closer to the stunted tree. They had kept below the crest and had not been sighted by the outlaws on the rim, who had been engrossed in knotting a second rope, brought up by the second man, to the end of the lariat tied to the tree. This had been dropped down the wall again, and now another outlaw was hanging to the rope and being drawn straight up the cliff like a water bucket by his two friends above. Slim and Laramie fired. Slim's bullet burned the fingers of a man clinging to the lariat. He let go of the rope and fell to the canyon floor. Laramie winged one of the men on the cliff, but it didn't affect his speed as he raced after his companion in a flight for cover. A barrage came up from the canyon as the men below spotted Laramie and his companion. Laramie and Slim ducked back, but continued firing after the men fleeing along the rim of the cliff and made no attempt to make a stand. They knew that the lone defender had received reinforcements, and they weren't stopping to learn in what force. Buck and Slim caught fleeting glimpses of the fugitives as they headed out through the hills.
Let them go. Be no more trouble from that quarter. I bet them Rannies won't try to climb that rope no more. Come on. I hear guns talking back at the tunnel.
Buck and Slim reached the punchers on the ledge in time to see three horsemen streaking it down the trail, with lead humming after them. Three more figures lay sprawled about the mouth of the tunnel, which had been substantially cleared. One of Slim's men was aiming after the fleeing men.
They busted out on horseback. Come so fast we couldn't stop them all.
One of the fleeing horsemen swayed in his saddle as the three ducked into the trees and out of sight.
They'll be hitting the trail now.
No, they won't. They was bound to see us. They know they ain't but five of us. They won't go far. They'll be sneaking back to shoot us in the back when their friends start busting out again.
Well, there's no racket coming from the tunnel now.
They're laying low for a spell. Too damn risky now. They didn't have but six horses in the tunnel. They gotta catch more and bring them to the tunnel before they can make the rush. Now wait till dark, and then we can't stop them unless we get more men. Slim, climb back up on the rim and lay down behind them rocks I stacked up. Watch that rope so nobody climbs it. We gotta cut that as soon as it gets dark. And don't let no horses be brought into the tunnel, if you can help it.
Slim took off, and a few moments later, his rifle could be heard.
They're already at it!
Wait! Listen!
They could hear it from down the trail, out of sight among the trees. After a pause, a crowd of men burst into view.
Reinforcements, by golly! It's a regular army!
Looks like old San Leon is there. Hey, boys! Don't get in line with that tunnel mouth! Spread out along the trail! Hey, who's them three fellas they got tied to their saddles?
The three that broke loose from the tunnel. They scooped them in as they come. Looks like everybody's there. There's Charlie Ross and Jim Watkins, the mayor, and Lon Evans, Mart Riley's bartender. Reckon he didn't know his boss was a crook. And by golly, look who's leading them!
Bob Anders!
Buck stared at the pale-faced but erect figure who, with bandaged head, rode ahead of the 30 or 40 men who came up the trail and swung wide through the brush to avoid the tunnel mouth. Anders saw Buck and waved his hand. Rifles were firing from the tunnel now, and the riders swung from their horses and began to take up positions on each side of the trail as Anders took in the situation at a glance. The townsmen's guns began to answer the shots of the outlaws. Laramie came clambering down the cliff to shake Anders' outstretched hand.
I came to just about the time you hit town today, Laramie. Was just telling Judy it couldn't have been you that shot me when all that hell busted loose and Judy run to help you out if she could. By the time I could get my clothes on, talk down the doctor, and get on the streets, you was gone with these addleheads chasing you. We had to wait till they gave up the chase and come back, and then me and Judy and Joe Waters lit into them. Time we got through, they was mighty contrite and aching to take a hand in your game.
Oh, you owe a lot. Especially your sister. Where's Raleigh?
We thought he was with us when we lit out after you. But when we started back, we missed him.
On the rim above them, Slim was firing frantically.
Look out! They're rushing through the tunnel on horses! Damn it! Why ain't somebody up here with me? I can't stop them all!
Evidently, the gang inside the canyon had been whipped to desperation by the arrival of the reinforcements, for they came thundering through the tunnel, laying down a barrage of lead. Total chaos. They ran full into a blast of lead that piled screaming horses and writhing men in a red shambles. The survivors staggered back into the tunnel. Struck by a sudden thought, Laramie groped among the bushes and hauled out the guard, Braxton, still bound and gagged. He was conscious now and glared balefully at his captor.
Buck tore the gag off.
Where's Harrison and Raleigh?
Raleigh rode for San Leon after you got away from us this morning. Harrison's gone. Got scared and pulled out. I don't know where he went.
You're lying.
What'd you ask me for if you know so much?
You mean Harrison's in on this, Buck? Joel told me about Raleigh.
In on it. Harrison is the kingpin and Raleigh's his chief sidewinder. I ain't seen neither Harrison nor Raleigh since I got here. Be just like them to double-cross their own men and run off with the loot they already got. But we still got this nest to clean out, and here's my idea. Them that's still alive in the canyon are denned up in or near the tunnel. Nobody near the cabin. If four or five of us can get hold up in there, we'll have them from both sides. We'll tie some lariats together, and some of us will go down the walls and get in the cabin. We'll scatter men along the rim to see that none of them climb out. And we'll leave plenty of men here to hold the tunnel if they try that again, which they will as soon as it begins to get dark if we don't scuttle them first.
Whew. You ought to have been the general, cowboy. Me and Slim and a couple of the Bar X boys will go for the cabin. You better stay here. Your shoulder ain't fit for tightrope work and such.
No. I aim to finish what I started.
All right. Let's go.
10 minutes later found the party of five clustered on the canyon rim. The sun hadn't yet set beyond the peaks, but the canyon below was in shadow. The spot Laramie had chosen for descent was some distance beyond the stunted tree. The rim there was higher, the wall even more precipitous. It had the advantage, however, of an outjut of rock that would partially serve to hide the descent of a man on a lariat from the men lurking below. And if anyone did observe the descent of the five invaders, there was no sign of it. Laramie came last, clinging with one hand and gritting his teeth against the pain of his wounded shoulder. The slow, torturous crawl across the canyon floor seemed endless, but they reached their goal with still enough light for their purpose. The cabin doors were shut, the windows closely shuttered. Anders had one hand on the door, drawn Colt in the other.
Let's go!
Wait! I stuck my head into a loop here once already today. You all stay here while I head around to the back and look things over from that side. Don't go in till you hear me holler.
Then Buck was sneaking around the cabin, gun in hand. He was little more than half the distance to the back when he was paralyzed to hear a voice from inside the cabin.
All clear!
What?
Before he could move or shout a warning, he heard Anders answer.
Coming, Buck!
Come on in, Sheriff!
Huh, what the hell?
With sick fury, Laramie realized that somebody lurking inside the cabin somehow knew what they were up to and tricked the sheriff into entering.
Now we can make terms, gentlemen. We've got your sheriff. You give us free passage to Mexico, or he's a dead man.
Buck charged for the rear of the house. Anders would never agree to buying freedom for that gang to save his own life. And Laramie knew that whatever truce might be agreed upon, Harrison would never let the sheriff live. Buck also knew that the rear door was of ordinary thin paneling. Bracing his good right shoulder, Laramie rammed his full charging weight against it. The door crashed inward, and he catapulted into the room, gun first. He saw a man wheeling from the doorway that led into the main room, and then he ducked and jerked the trigger as a knife sang past his head. The knife thrower hit the floor and lay twitching. Laramie caught a glimpse of men standing momentarily frozen in the act of tying Bob Anders to a chair. Eli Harrison, a Mexican man, and Mart Wally. Then, all hell broke loose. The bound Bob Anders lurched out of the chair, rolling clumsily toward the wall. Buck half-rolled behind the partial cover of a cast-iron stove, drawing his second gun. Mart Wally fled to the bunk room, shooting as he went. He crouched inside the door, awaiting his chance. But Harrison, already badly wounded, went berserk. Disdaining cover, touched with madness, he came storming across the room, firing away. Buck raised himself to his full height and put a bullet through Harrison's heart. With one cartridge left in his last gun, Laramie leaned back against the wall, out of range of the bunk room.
Come on out, Raleigh. Harrison's dead. Your game's played out.
No, it ain't. Not till you're bleeding out, you son of a bitch. Before I kill you, I want you to know that you won't be the first Laramie I've sent to hell. I'd have thought you'd have known me, in spite of these whiskers. My real name's Rawlins.
Rawlins? You're the one who killed Luke!
That's right. I made friends with your brother and got him drunk till he told me all about this hideout and the trails across the desert. Then when he was too drunk to stand, I shot him in the back, just to keep his mouth shut. Now what are you gonna do about it, Bucky?
Nothing much. I'm just gonna kill you.
Sheriff? Buck? Are you all right?
Just at that moment, Slim and the men with him started through the doorway that Buck had burst through. Rollins swung his gun in their direction, leaning out just enough to give Buck a target. Buck's last bullet punched a neat hole in the head of his brother's murderer.
Holy mother. There sure are a lot of dead people in here.
Slim, see if Bob's hurt.
I'm fine. I fell out of the chair and rolled out of the line of fire when the lead started slinging. My hands are tied, though.
Cut him loose, Slim. I'm feeling kind of poorly.
Like a man in a daze, Buck staggered to a chair and sank down heavily on it. He was hardly aware when Bob Anders came and cut his blood-soaked shirt away and washed his wounds, dressing them as best he could with strips torn from his own shirt and whiskey from a jug found on the table. As Buck and the sheriff emerged into the cool dusk, Slim came running up.
The men in the tunnel, they're making a parley, Bob. They want to know if they'll be given a fair trial if they surrender.
I'll talk to them. The rest of you keep undercover.
At the head of the canyon, the sheriff stopped when he was within earshot of the men in and about the tunnel.
Are you men ready to give in?
What's your terms, Sheriff?
I ain't making terms. You'll all get a fair trial and an honest court. You better make up your minds. I know there ain't a lot of you left. Harrison's dead and so is Raleigh. I got 40 men outside this canyon and enough inside behind you to wipe you out. Throw your guns out here where I can see them and come out with your hands high.
Rifles and pistols were tossed on the bare earth, and with their hands in the air, haggard, blood-stained, powder-blackened men rose from behind the rocks and came out of the tunnel.
We give up. Four of the boys are laying back amongst the rocks, too shot up to move under their own power. One's got a broke leg where his horse fell on him. Some of the rest of us need to have wounds dressed.
Laramie and Slim and the punchers came out of cover, with guns trained on the weary outlaws.
All right, men. Let's get those four wounded out of the rocks, and we'll see what we can do for them.
A curious parade came filing through the tunnel into the outer valley where twilight still lingered. And as Buck Laramie emerged from that dark tunnel, he felt as if his dark past had fallen from him like a worn-out coat. Sheriff Anders and Buck talked to the man who'd acted as spokesman for the outlaws.
How did Harrison get mixed up in this deal?
Mixed hell. He planned the whole thing. He was cashier in the bank when the Laramies robbed it. The real ones, I mean. If it hadn't been for that robbery, old Brown would have soon found out that Harrison was stealing from him. But the Laramies killed Brown and give Harrison a chance to cover his tracks. They got blamed for what he'd stole, as well as the money they actually took. And that'd give Harrison an idea. The Laramies had acted as scapegoats for him once, and he aimed to use them again. But he had to wait till he could get to be president of the bank, and it had taken time to round up a gang.
So he'd ruin the ranchers and send his coyotes out of the country and then be king of San Leon. We know that part of it. Where'd Rollins come in?
Harrison knowed him years ago on the Rio Grande. When Harrison aimed to raise his gang, he went to Mexico and found Rollins. Harrison knowed the real Laramies had a secret hideout, so Rollins made friends with Luke Laramie and...
Yeah, we know all about that.
Oh, well, everything was fine till word come from Mexico that Buck Laramie was riding up from there. Harrison got skittish. He thought Laramie was coming to take toll for his brother. So he sent Rollins to waylay Laramie. Rollins missed, but later went on to San Leon to try again. He shot you instead, Anders. Word was out to get you anyway. You'd been prowling too close to our hideout to suit Harrison. Harrison seemed to go kind of loco when he first heard Laramie was heading this way. He made us pull that fool stunt of a fake bank holdup so he could act the hero and nobody would suspect him. Hell, nobody suspected him anyway. And he risked coming out here. But he was panicky and wanted us to get ready to make a clean sweep tonight and pull out. When Laramie got away from us this morning, Harrison decided he'd ride to Mexico with us. Well, when the fighting started, Harrison and Raleigh stayed out of sight. I guess there's nothing they could do, and they hoped we'd be able to break out of the canyon. See, they didn't want to be seen and recognized. If it turned out Laramie hadn't told anybody he was head of the gang, Harrison would have been able to stay on then.
Preparations were being made to start back to San Leon with the prisoners when a sheepish-looking delegation headed by Mayor Jim Watkins approached Buck.
Look here, Laramie. We owe you something now, and we're just as hard to pay our debts as you are to pay yours. Harrison had a small ranch out a ways from town, which he ain't needin' no more, and he ain't got no heirs, so we can get it easy enough. We thought if you was aiming maybe to stay around San Leon, we'd like to make you a present of that ranch and kind of help you get a start in the cow business. And we don't want the 50,000 Waters said you aimed to give us. You've wiped out that debt.
A curious melancholy had settled over Buck. After all the furious emotions of the past few days, he felt weary and a bit lost.
Thanks. But I'm paying that 50,000 back to the men it belonged to. And I'll be moving on tomorrow.
Where to?
I don't know yet.
Well, you think it over.
Let's go, Buck. You need some attention on them wounds.
You go ahead, Bob. I'll be alone. I kind of want to sit here and rest.
A vital chapter in Buck Laramie's life had closed. He had kept his vow. Now, he had no plan or purpose to take its place.
Hey, the buckboard! And look who's driving!
Laramie's heart gave a convulsive leap and then started pounding as he saw the slim, supple figure beside Jewel Waters. She pulled up near them and handed the lines to Slim, who sprang to help her down.
Oh, careful, miss.
Biggest fight ever fought in San Leon County, and I didn't get to fire a shot. Cuss a busted leg anyway.
You done a man's part anyway, Joe.
And then Buck forgot Jewel Waters entirely in the miracle of seeing Judy Anders standing before him, smiling gently, her hand outstretched, and the rising moon melting her soft hair to golden.
I'm sorry for the way I spoke to you today. I've been bitter about things that were none of your fault.
Don't apologize. Please, you saved my neck. You was probably right anyhow. Anyway, Bob went down the trail with the others. You must have missed him.
I saw him and talked to him. I came on, expecting to meet you.
You came on to meet me? Oh, of course, Joe would want to see how bad I was shot up.
Mr. Waters wanted to see you, of course. But Buck, I wanted to see you too.
She was leaning close to him, looking up at him, and he was dizzy with the fragrance and beauty of her.
You did? What would you want to see me for?
I wanted to apologize for my rudeness this morning.
I told you not to apologize. You saved my life, and I... Oh, heck, Judy, I love you.
Buck was frozen by his own audacity, stunned and paralyzed. But suddenly, Judy was in his arms.
Oh, I love you too, Buck. I've loved you ever since I was a little girl and we went to school together. Only I've tried to force myself not to think of you for the past 6 years. But I've loved the memory of you. That's why it hurt me so to think that you'd gone bad as I thought you had. Oh, Buck, to learn you're straight and honorable is like having a black shadow lifted from between us. You'll never leave me, Buck.
Leave you? Just long enough to find the mayor and tell him I'm taking him up on an offer he made. And then I'm aiming on spending the rest of my life making you happy.
I reckon there'll be a marrying in these parts pretty soon, Slim.
Woo-hoo, looks like it.
Who knows? I'm liable to get married myself any day now.
You don't say.
Why, sure. It's just a matter of time till I decide what type of woman would make me the best wife.
Stage Station by Ernest Haycox.
It is ready.
Rosalia Durez gave the table one last glance to make sure that the owner, who believed it a sin to be ungenerous, could find no fault with the meal. The arrival of Tobe Urquhart, driving the Tonto stage, shattered the hot drowse lying all about Folliard Station.
15 minutes to eat. Do what you gotta do.
Oh, my. I've become a bit lightheaded.
Well, let me help you, Mrs. King.
The light of the desert was a white-hot blast, and when the woman stepped into the thick shadows of this adobe-walled room, she put out her hands as though blinded. The other passengers crowded around her, and her shoulders tipped a little, and then the owner stepped into the room, and the woman caught the front of his shirt with her fingers.
Oh, it has made me a little faint.
From the corner of the room, Rosalia Durez observed this with a practical and dissenting interest. The woman was surrounded by men, but it was the owner on whom she placed her hands, and the owner looked at her and was pleased. There was, Rosalia thought, nothing wrong with the woman's eyes. Tobe jerked his thumb.
Miss King, this is Tom Folliard, who runs the station. It's one of the few stations in Arizona the Apaches ain't had any luck with.
There you go.
The owner helped Mrs. King to the table and took his own place. Everybody, made impatient by time and hunger, fell upon the meal. Rosalia stepped forward, her round and white and firm arms grazing the owner's shoulders as she poured his coffee. It was against his wishes to be served first, but Rosalia, obedient in most things, had her own gently stubborn convictions. This was the owner's house, and this was his table. Afterward, she moved to Mrs. King. There was a perfume in Mrs. King's chestnut hair and firmness to her skin. The day's heat had deepened her complexion. Small, faint freckles showed around the base of her nose. Rosalia Durez's appearance instantly drew Mrs. King's quick and close regard, and there was at the moment no smiling in her eyes. They were cool and made heavy by a dark old wisdom, and they turned from Rosalia to the owner and back to Rosalia again, until Rosalia knew what the Senora was thinking.
If only it were true.
She circled the table with her own eyes discreetly lowered and went into the kitchen. Her mother moved from the hot stove.
I hear a woman out there. There is danger in the desert for a woman.
She would not be afraid.
Rosalia moved back to the dining room. She stood in a corner, listening. Tobe Urquhart took a breath from eating and turned to the owner.
Should be a cavalry guard waiting at the top of the pass. Any Apache sign around here?
Not much.
Any sign is too much. All right, folks.
They rose at his word. Tobe Urquhart was a tall man, but the owner was taller. The owner had heavy shoulders and heavy legs, and he had a voice that made men turn. All the sun in Arizona couldn't darken his skin, and his lips were long and made for smiling, but they were firm at the corners, and his eyes were gray. Rosalia saw how strong was the Senora's interest as she watched the owner. The Senora was fair and pretty. She put a palm gracefully toward her head.
Oh, I had not counted on this heat. It will be much worse this afternoon. If you don't mind, I'll stay over until the next stage, Mr. Folliard.
Her appetite was not ill.
Certainly.
The owner, Thomas, seemed pleased and followed the other passengers into the glass-glittering light.
We'll keep an eye out for marauders. I'll be happy to get to the pass with the cavalry. So long. Yeah!
The stage's wheels groaned into motion, and for a little while the run of the horses was a descending beat in the day. Then the solid, sultry quiet returned to Folliard Station, and the owner came in with Senora King's flower-patterned portmanteau.
Rosalia, which room will Mrs. King use? Mrs. King, this is Rosalia Durez.
Rosalia lowered her eyes.
How are you, Rosalia?
Tom Folliard looked at Senora King, not understanding the tone. Rosalia walked down the dusk-gray hall of the Dobie's rambling wing into a small room. Senora King's stiff dress and petticoats rustled behind her, and the owner's feet softly tramped the rammed earth floor. Rosalia walked to the deep window slit and pulled back the shutter so that some of the day's blinding light might stain the gushed warm shadows of the room. Senora King stood near the owner, with her chin lifted and her lips smiling. There was an expression in her eyes.
It is not modest.
Rosalia, who knew the shape and shadow of the owner's every mood, saw that he was pleased.
If there is anything you need, call Rosalia or me.
Rosalia went back along the hall, still hearing the owner's steps behind her. Luce padded in and out of the room, bearing away the dinner dishes. Luce was a careless Apache boy and needed the eye of authority on him, and so Rosalia stood in the corner and supplied that need. She wore a black skirt and a white linen shirtwaist with short sleeves, and her hair, black as brilliant lacquer, was pulled back from her forehead into a round knot held by a semicircular comb. Her lips were serene, and her eyes were dreaming and grave. At her hip hung a small chain holding three keys. She watched the owner cross the room and go into the brilliant flash of day. She turned to the kitchen.
Luz, you are lazy. I will speak to the owner.
Senora Duras sat comfortably by a kitchen table, drinking her coffee. At middle age, Senora Duras had the fine, hard, camellia-clear skin and features of a high-bred Spanish woman. Moisture lay on her upper lip, but she was very loose and comfortable in the chair, and her practical eyes considered her daughter.
I saw the woman. The best fruit has been picked from that tree. Why is she here?
She has a sickness.
Ah, the owner is a well-set man, and the desires of women have followed him before now.
Senora Duras sipped coffee, watching her daughter.
But he will do her no good. American men are cold.
The owner is not cold.
Has he looked at you? Has there been in his eyes a thing to make you afraid or glad? With Tomas Folliard, you are as safe as in the tomb. With a Spanish man, it would be impossible. It would be a wound to his pride to disregard the possibilities of a woman.
The owner is not cold. I saw his face when he looked at Senora King.
She lowered her eyes from the critical examination of her mother.
You are 23. It is a shame. It is not that you are plain, for you are not. It is not that you are of poor blood. The Duras were a great people in Spain 200 years ago. You do not know your gifts. You are shy. You need younger women to instruct you and Spanish men to try your eyes on. I should take you to Cousin Felipe's in Tucson.
Spanish men. They do nothing but talk and smoke cigarettes in the sunshine, as you yourself have said.
So.
As a young girl, Senora Duras had married Duras, who had been 50. And on the wedding night, he had stayed away, drinking until his friends brought him home and laid him like a log on the bed. Men were difficult at times. And though she was doubtful of American ways, she had a sympathy for her daughter and was tolerant. She laid her hands across her knees.
If the Signora brought a look to the face of Don Tomas, it may be you can learn from her.
It is not the way. A man must see for himself. The owner is lonely, and the Signora King reminds him of his people. Luz, move faster, or I will send you back to the hills.
She went down the shadowed hall, past the door of Senora King's room, past the little bar room with its rank smell of tobacco and whiskey, and out to the backyard. The hills in the distance were ashen gray and iron brown under the beating light, and up there on the bare summits, Apaches would be watching. Always they watched. Always, at night, they crept down. This was the heart of Indian country, with no settlement nearer than 20 miles. But the owner's walls were thick, and the owner had never deserted his station. Long and low and solid, the adobe house faced the wicked emptiness. Behind lay the ramparts of the hills. In front, the white, flat, endless floor of the desert stretched away. And far, far off, the heat haze closed down. The stage road's twin ruts came out of the northern desert and vanished in the rocks and stiff-standing cacti southward. A horse laid its nose against the surface of the pool of water. Gutierrez, the Mexican hostler, slept in a shady angle of the mesquite fence. Rosalia returned along the dusky corridor to the main room. The owner sat in his big chair by the front door. He had his back to her. His feet were spread forward. His cigar's pale blue smoke spiraled in the room's dusk. The shutters hung closed and the door stood shut, but faint pencil streaks of light searched through the cracks, diamond bright. Rosalia watched the owner's black head roll a little against the chair's rung. His skin was light and his shoulders spread very wide. When he raised his cigar to his mouth, she caught the heavy row of knuckles on his fist. She made no sound. She stood still. She stood dreaming.
Rosalia?
Rosalia's heart quickened. The owner had sharp ears. He had a sense for things around him. She walked on until she stood before him. His hair tumbled around his head. He had a sleepy, heavy, troubled look. His lips were tight at the corners, and the gray in his eyes seemed darker. He was a young man, and he was lonely.
Was there something for tonight you wanted?
No, I leave that all to you. The keys are yours, Rosalia.
The keys are only for rooms. They do not unlock all things.
You must speak to Luz. He is worth nothing. He is an Apache. He dreams like an Apache, even when he washes dishes. One day he will take a knife and stab you.
Has he bothered you?
Me, Tomas? No.
She squared her small shoulders, and then she was willful and calm and afraid of nothing.
I would skin him alive.
The owner's smile took the loneliness from his face. There was a look in his eyes that sent up the beating of her heart again. She held herself steady, and she knew he was interested, and kept her lips even and gentle. Something shone in his eyes. It came and passed, and was not quite as it had been when the Signora King had placed her hands on his chest. Rosalia turned away. At 4 o'clock, the house awoke. Rosalia stirred around the long table, and the Mexican hands appeared to water stock and to run in the cattle from the outer range. Tom Folliard went to the barn to see that the relief horses were fed and ready for the Lordsburg stage. At sundown, the owner returned to the house. The table was set. Mrs. King sat in a chair with her hands in her lap. She watched Rosalia. Her head was turned, and the side of her neck showed a sharp line, and her lips were pressed in from thought. At sight of Folliard, this faded, and she was smiling, and she was softly at ease in the chair. Rosalia stood by the table with her face thoughtfully bowed over its dishes.
You didn't come from this country originally, Mr. Folliard?
No. I drifted into Arizona Territory as a runaway boy 8 years ago. My people all live in Maine.
I knew you were a Yankee. Well, so am I, from Rhode Island. I married Lieutenant King the year he graduated from the academy. He was killed last summer by the Sioux.
For you, it's a long way from home.
I've been visiting at Fort Whipple. Now I'm going on to New Orleans. I have people there.
She paused, and her hands expressively turned.
I hate to go. This land. I hate to leave it.
Her voice was a soft, steady breeze, fanning alive a fire in him. Rosalia saw this. The sun dropped over the rim of the desert. Rosalia could hear the distant sound of the Lordsburg stage running up. Folliard left the room. Mrs. King stared at Rosalia, and her shoulders fell lower in the chair. The stage came off the desert, and the passengers came into the room, stiff-jointed, weary, and relieved. Cole Dury, the driver, gave the soldier a look.
Major, I'm hoping to catch a little help from your boys in blue. Always gives me a comfort to see them nearby. Yes, sir.
There were four of them, one an army major in crumpled blue, with the yellow piping of the cavalry branch running down his trouser leg. The owner came in, and for a moment, all the men were restrained by the presence of a woman.
Whoa.
This is Mrs. King, gentlemen.
The army major's bow was a faint break at the hips. Afterward, they sat down. Rosalia circled the table, her white, round arm poising the coffee pot and pouring. She watched the owner's face turn toward Senora King, and saw the Senora's quick, frank smile answer him at once, willing and eager. But there was a thing here the owner did not see. The army major sat opposite Senora King, and there were times when his glance touched her and remained on her with a full curiosity. There was a look on the major's face that was not like the look of a stranger. It was bolder and wiser, more insistent. Cull Dury rose promptly at the quarter hour.
Time to go.
The passengers filed out. The Major paused before Mrs. King.
I've not had the pleasure of meeting you since last year in Tucson.
Rosalia held her shoulders still. The owner listened. Senora King's face by lamplight was grave, and its color diminished.
I'm on my way to New Orleans, Major.
I wish you luck, Mrs. King.
The Major gave his faint bow and left the room. Senora King's smile, small and brief, touched the owner as he followed these men into the compound. And then the Senora's smile died, and support seemed to leave her shoulders. She wheeled and sat in a corner chair, darkened by the shadows.
Bring my coffee here.
Yes, Senora.
Rosalia brought the cup. The Senora's eyes, lifting to her, were wide open. They were old and desperate. Luce, the Apache boy, padded in to take away the used dishes. The Mexican hands came in to eat, and the owner appeared and took a chair beside Senora King. He put his long legs before him and pulled cigar smoke deeply into his chest. His half-curly hair made a black shine under the lamp. Rosalia, back in the room's corner, saw the owner change. His big fists were loose on the arms of the chair, and the corners of his mouth were not tight. And he had forgotten, he who so seldom forgot, the Apaches back on the rim of the Mesquites. The owner was dreaming. Rosalia knew what his dreams were. She lowered her head so that her eyes might not see. Night's startling black swept over the station, and heat drifted out of the room. And then, because this was the only shelter, men began to creep in from the wild heart of the desert and in from the treacherous hills. A friendly Mescalero chief came to the room as silently as the cool night came, and ate and sat a while and spoke 10 words and was gone. Charles Rice, one of Crook's scouts, came in. He waved a hand at the hills, indicating trouble. A cowpuncher from the Santa Rita rode up. A solitary civilian messenger from Fort Apache appeared. These were all men who knew the country by heart, and it was at night they did their traveling. They ate and talked a while with the drowsy, brief phrases of their kind. They fell silent when a rider drummed into the compound and continued silence as he entered.
The bad one again.
The owner, who was a just and impartial man, turned to the newcomer.
Hello, Bill. Take a chair.
Peso Bill was old in wickedness, but his eyes were bright and careless. He was slim, and he could laugh quickly and show these people an insolence, which he did. For he knew how well the owner's hospitality sheltered him as long as he was within these walls. Alkali dust clung heavy on his clothes, and it caked his face like powder. He sat to the table with his hat on. Black, lank hair came down beneath the brim. When Rosalia poured his coffee, Peso Bill stared at her, his smile very sharp. Rosalia moved away at once, and the owner's chin lifted a little, and he watched Peso Bill with a moment's hardening attention. The silence of the room surrounded Peso Bill like a wall.
How did you come to pick this place?
The owner smiled at the question, as though it brought back a fresh memory.
One day, this was 5 years ago, I took the stage out of Lordsburg intending for Tonto. We broke an axle about here. There was nothing at the time between Lordsburg and Tonto at all. I liked the spot, came back to it later and put up my station. But someday this range will all be used. It's a matter of waiting. This is pretty fair cattle country. I had 500 head run off by the Apaches.
Charlie Rice, the cavalry scout, pulled his pipe stem.
Yep, in the morning, ma'am. Go outside and look at the bullet marks on the walls.
The owner showed a smile, a sign to Rosalia that he was pleased with the recollection. The owner's jaw was a long, solid line, and there was no man in this room, Rosalia told herself, who did not have a trust in him. Even Peso Bill trusted him.
My people were all sailing men. My father is on the sea now. It's a far cry to the desert, but this is a good land.
But there is no difference, really. The desert is like the sea. This house is the only thing on it for miles. You are responsible for these people. You are the captain, Mr. Folliot.
Charlie Rice landed a speculative and taciturn glance at the Senora. The fancy attracted him. All these men looked at the Senora and were pleased with her presence. Men were men, and made so for a purpose. But they could not see.
Peso Bill reared from his chair.
I'd like a drink, Captain.
He showed the owner a malice with his eyes. When he stood up this way, his right arm brushed the back-curved butt of his gun. The owner weighed Peso Bill briefly, still holding judgment out of his face. He nodded to Rosalia, who walked down the hall with Peso Bill. She turned into the small bar room, unlocked the cupboard, and placed bottle and glass before him. Peso Bill poured his drink and took it at one impatient tip of his head. He put his elbow on the bar and watched her until Rosalia, who was a discerning girl, saw devils dancing their pinpoint brightness along the pupils of his eyes. The man harbored a greediness within a want. He moved his hand forward until he touched her waist, and he waited, cat-like, to see what she would do. Rosalia stood still, composed and scornful.
Signor is a fool. You want more out of this bottle?
Maybe.
He moved around the bar.
The Spanish woman is a hellcat, but I know it.
There was a shadow in the doorway strong enough for Peso Bill to feel. He turned around, and Rosalia almost smiled to see this. The owner, a big man, had come down the hall without sound and stood over Peso Bill with blackness on his face. His eyes reduced to small streaks of light, and the owner had his fury, but he held it back.
Ride out, Bill, and don't come back.
Peso Bill's smile was whiter, and he paused with his head tipped aside.
About that, I...
What?
Other men were riding forward through the black, which was a sound that took Peso Bill out of the side door on the run. Rosalia heard his horse rush away toward the south. Her lips were smooth and her heart beat faster. She kept her eyes down while she put away the whiskey and locked the cupboard again. When she turned to leave the barroom, the owner was still in the door, and it was necessary that she look up. The blackness shone still on his face.
Rosalia, hereafter I'll wait on this bar. It's a poor place for a woman.
Of what am I afraid, Tomas? Certainly of no man.
He kept watching her, and this pause was strange, for the owner was no man to hesitate. Men were in the yard. They were coming into the living room.
You have guests, Tomas.
She followed him down the hall, pleased that his back was so high and wide against the lamplight. There were four men in this new party, and one was James Braid, who wore a Marshall star.
Tom, Peso Bill has raised hell in Tonto. He killed Lyle McGarra. His second shot hit Henry Graham's wife. Miss Graham is poorly.
This was as much of a question as the marshal would ask, knowing that he stood under the owner's roof. The owner was not a talking man, and if he said anything now, it would be because of the badness of Peso Bill's bullet striking a woman. A silence held. The owner moved a hand across his jaw.
I wouldn't know anything about Peso Bill, Jim. Sit up to the table and we'll get something to eat.
Why, I?
The owner looked at Senora King with a steadiness more important than words. The other men in the room kept still, and the marshal's face, as he watched the Senora, showed faintly amused.
We're a long way from home, boys.
That was all. They went back to the yard. Everybody listened to the fading run of their horses.
I'm quite sorry.
No harm done. Jim Braid knows I can't talk. All kinds of men come to my place. I question no man and answer none. On the desert, it has to be like that.
Is that moonlight I see on the ground?
She rose, and Rosalia, watching from the background, saw the power of the other woman's wish reach out and lift the owner from his chair. The Senora placed her hand on the owner's arm. They left the room. Rosalia finished her duties. In time, the civilian messenger and the cowhand and Charlie Rice went to bed, and the Senora turned to her room. In her own room, Rosalia listened to the house settle and grow still. She changed to her long white nightgown and braided her hair in two pigtails and stood a moment, grave and young, and caught by some thought that softened her lips and made her eyes glow. She took up a Hopi blanket from the bed and wrapped it around her shoulders and padded barefoot down the hall to the edge of the living room. The owner sat in a corner chair with his back to her. He held a cigar poised in one hand. He wasn't smoking it. He would be thinking, and he would be lonely.
The Senora had a way, Rosalia thought, and looked down at her small toes. Her heart quickened, and her toes crept forward until they were almost in the room. This was as far as she could go. Turning, she returned along the hall to the Senora's room. There was a light shining beneath the door, and Rosalia pushed the door open and entered. The Senora sat at a table, with her shoulders bowed forward and her glance fixed into a small mirror. She jerked around.
What do you want?
Did the Senora want anything? Come here.
Rosalia walked nearer, seeing the coldness of Senora King's eyes and the hard knowledge in them.
How old are you?
I am 23. You are older. Is that not so, Senora?
Go away. Go away!
Rosalia returned to her room and made her prayers and listened to the broken cry of the coyotes on the bench not far away. This was another day, with the light of the desert growing brighter and hotter, and the horizon slowly sinking behind a powder-blue heat haze. At 11:30, Peso Bill rode down from the mesquites in great haste. Rosalia, moving around the dining room table, heard the drum of his horse and paused at the slitted window long enough to identify him. Alkali, as before, clung thick and fresh on his clothes. He had pushed his hat away from his face. All his features were thin and expressive, and he was smiling at the owner who suddenly appeared. The owner stood before Peso Bill's horse.
Keep going, Bill.
Man's a fool to ride alone.
That's your trouble, not mine. I've got no place here for you.
You wouldn't push a man away without water or grub.
Water your horse and break the dust.
Maybe. Maybe.
I've told you.
The owner walked deliberately away toward the barn. Rosalia turned back to the table to make sure that the owner, who was a generous man, would find no fault with the food. The stage coming in from Tonto would be here in half an hour. Senora King walked from her room and crossed to the door. She wore a plum-colored dress that rustled as she moved. Her chestnut hair lay in smooth folds on her head, and her lips set fixed in softness. She went into the compound. Rosalia hurried through the kitchen to the back door. Peso Bill's horse nosed the water in the dirt pool. Peso Bill stooped over the mouth of the pipe and drank with his hat removed. His lank hair fell down around his ears. He straightened and replaced the hat. Water clung to his face, but he made no move to brush it away. His eyes came over to the kitchen door and saw Rosalia. He smiled again. Rosalia turned through the kitchen. The owner came down the long hall with a quick, soft step. His shoulders were wide and heavy against the shadows, and his face shone grave as he reached for his gun and belt hanging on the wall. When he strapped it around his waist, he turned to look at Rosalia. She stood straight and still. Her eyes shone dark, but composure held her lips even.
Thomas?
The owner walked through the front door into the compound.
Oh, Thomas! Thomas, what are you going to do?
Through the slitted window, Rosalia saw Peso Bill round the corner of the dobe without his horse. He walked on with a swing to his hips, faced the owner over a distance of 20 yards, and stopped.
I see you got your rig on, Folliard. What's that for?
You know what it's for.
Rosalia swung to a corner of the room, seized up the rifle, canted against the wall, and hurried toward the door.
To hell with you, Folliard.
You had my order, Bill. Move back to your horse.
Peso Bill moved for his gun. Rosalia ran through the door into the compound, feeling sound collapse around her. Her eyes turned for the owner. She saw him standing with his feet apart and the revolver half lowered. Peso Bill had fallen. He didn't move. Senora King ran from the dobe wall of the house. She ran with her shoulders pulled together and her arms clenched. She stopped near Peso Bill. Rosalia put the butt of the rifle on the ground and laid a hand over her mouth and drew it away. Astonishment changed the owner's face as he watched the Senora. He listened to her, and there was a pain in his eyes at hearing that shrillness, that outpour. Rosalia said nothing, but the owner's eyes came around, and he saw the gun she held. Rosalia, at the moment, looked upon the fallen Peso Bill, and her grave features pitied the man. Even though she would have killed Peso Bill, regret came to her now. She stood straight-shouldered in the full glare of the sun, soft-eyed and sad. This is what the owner saw. There was a loose ball of dust in the north, which would be the Tonto stage rolling up. Senora King came back to the owner, her cheeks brilliant, flushed, and she stared at him with willingness on her lips.
You remember what I told you, Thomas? You are the captain.
The stage is coming, Mrs. King. You'll have time to pack and eat.
Rosalia turned at once and went into the house. She was there by the table when Senora King entered and walked toward the hall. The Senora's eyes looked very old. They reached Rosalia and hated Rosalia. And then the Senora vanished into her room. The owner appeared through the door. Rosalia lowered her eyes, and her heart beat fast and strong. The owner stopped before her.
Rosalia?
Then she saw the look in his eyes. The look that Senora King had brought there. But it was not for Senora King. It was for her. For Rosalia Duras.
Tomas.
Rosalia. He said no more, for the stage had rolled up before the station.
15 minutes for lunch.
The owner walked reluctantly out. Rosalia stood in the shadows.
I should thank the signora, for Tomas has seen me, and it was she who made him see.
The passengers came in. It was a hard ride, and these days a dangerous ride from Tonto to Folliard's. After they had seated themselves at the table, Rosalia moved forward, and when she poured the owner's coffee, her round white arm gently touched his shoulder and brought out his smile. The owner did not like to be served first, but there was a gentle stubbornness in Rosalia. This was the owner's house and his table. Next meal, she would sit at the table's other end, with Luce serving.